Good afternoon. My name is David Van Cleve, and I'm the president of the Harvard Law School Forum. Today, we are delighted to have with us Edward Asner, an actor and an activist. Most of us have grown up knowing the Lou Grant character. The Mary Tyler Moore Show ran from 1970 through 1977, and with more than 100 episodes being produced. The Lou Grant Show ran from 1977 through 1982, again with over 100 episodes. I think it's not unfair to say that many of us derive our concept of life within a television newsroom or a big city newspaper in large part from these two award-winning television series. But Edward Asner's acting career encompasses much more than Lou Grant. Mr. Asner has appeared in Broadway and off-Broadway productions. He has won awards for his appearances in the miniseries Roots and Rich Man, Poor Man, and he has been in a number of films, including Fort Apache, The Bronx. Currently, Mr. Asner stars in the NBC series The Bronx Zoo and is touring the country in the play Born Yesterday, which will move from Boston to New York in mid-January by way of a number of other cities that we were discussing at lunch. For an actor with such consistent and varied work, Mr. Asner has been surprisingly active when not on stage or on the screen. He has served as president of the Screen Actors Guild for two terms and has been very active in many humanitarian and political organizations, especially those that work toward peace in Central America and promote human rights. As you may have noted from the posters advertising this event, Mr. Asner welcomes the job title activist as well as actor. It is with that in mind that I introduce Edward Asner.
I'm really awed by this room. I love it. I really love it. The carving and everything. I've never spoken in such a room. I feel like an early Viking. I want to be buried in this room and set it on fire, of course. And I have a few choice dogs to put at my feet. Thank you for inviting me to speak at the Harvard Law School Forum. I'm honored to be in your company and feel unqualified, but I'll forge ahead blithely. In light of your many distinguished graduates and professors, including the one who opened the Maven's Kosher Court Deli nearby. Right now I'm doing Born Yesterday in Boston with Madeline. It's not my first visit to your beautiful city. My daughter Liza is a senior at Northeastern, majoring in communications. And I was here at Harvard 5 years ago. I've aged, speaking to the Institute of Politics. So now I've spoken at the schools of politics and law, and I'm a little surprised I'd be invited as a pundit in both areas, though, considering how unrelated politics is to law these days. But if it helps, I played several lawyers in my career. For Showtime, I played Louis Neiser in a case of libel, prosecuting the famous Westbrook Pegler in a libel case. About the same time, I played a character based on Julius and Ethel Rosenberg's lawyer, Emanuel Block, in the feature movie Daniel, which was vilified throughout the country's press at the time. It seems that after I act a role, I tend to keep up the interest in the subject matter. Unfortunately, I've never played a pimp, but that's all. There's always the future. I've kept in touch with several lawyers I've met then, as well as the Rosenberg son, Robert and Michael Mirapol. And by the way, the art in the Rosenberg era is now featured at the Massachusetts College of Art through December 23rd. So if you get a chance to see it, it's worth it. Art of that period. I still keep in touch with many journalists from my Lou Grant days. And hell, I still correspond with some wrestlers I met 15 years ago when I played a wrestling promoter in a movie that was never released. It's part of what I find fascinating about being an actor, the people I associate with, the jobs, the places that they always send you to, some of the worst armpits in the world, and at the same time some of the most lovely Edens, people in the same fashion too. Those roles I mentioned are as close to being a lawyer as I'll ever get. I didn't put in the years of study you have, especially the gray-haired, bald-headed ones here. I didn't put in those years of study or pay the tuition. I understand Harvard Law School costs about $22,000 a year now. Actually, my chances would have been slim even if I'd wanted to become a lawyer. I attended the University of Chicago but had to drop out when the money dropped out. So it's to your credit that you made it this far, especially considering the Reagan administration's total lack of support for education and its constant cutting of financial aid and other critical programs. Of course, when I had to leave college, I felt like a failure. I can do that on any bad day now. I'd done some radio drama during high school and had acted at the university, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I didn't have great involvement with school, but I was too chicken to strike out on my own. I went back to Kansas City, my home. I moped around. I became a slug. Then I got a job at a fancy shoe salon. We had one customer in 1 week, and I realized I was not going to stage my comeback campaign at that location. Then I tried being a door-to-door salesman, Encyclopedia Britannica. I wasn't tough enough to cram unwanted merchandise down poor victims' throats, so I left that endeavor. Adventure certainly appealed to me, as did getting out of Kansas City. So I admired a very lovely ad from an export company, and I responded to it. They were looking for someone to handle their office in Venezuela. They sent me to their banking expert, who counseled me about Venezuela, told me I couldn't bring my wife to La Guaira, it was too tropical for North American women. And I said, well, I could set up shop in Caracas, couldn't I? Or set up my home in Caracas and do my business in La Guaira. He said, yes, you could do that. So I figured I might do that. So he also told me how much money I needed to set up the office and make preliminary contacts. Being penniless, it was more money than I had. But he quickly added that the guy with the franchise for Baby Grands had made a killing down there, and the guy with Good Humor Bar's franchise had made a killing. He said I would be a very important part of the company, and that would be as U.S. representative in Venezuela for the Dean Prophylactic Company. He said if I did well, I could expand into Brazil. I thought about it. Peddling prophylactics in a Roman Catholic country did not bode well for success. Of course, 40 years later, with the advent of AIDS, prophylactics don't seem ludicrous wherever you are. So I still gave up my grand plans for the export business. Applied for a job at a General Motors assembly plant in Kansas City as a spot polisher and buffer. I tried to quit my first day, but I couldn't find the foreman. Ultimately, I decided it was not my life's work either. I was a lousy spot polisher and buffer. So I drifted back to Chicago doing odd jobs badly and occasional plays at the University of Chicago. I wasn't a student any longer, but they would let outsiders act with them. Then after fighting the Korean War in France, I teamed up with Paul Sills, who ran the Playwrights Theater Company. We had a lovely 2 years of indoctrination and performing for me in front of Second City Chicago audiences. And then I left for New York while Paul created Compass and its famous players, most famous of those being Mike and Elaine. Barbara Harris was third. He followed that up with Second Sin and all the creation that came out of that. In the meantime, I was slogging my way through New York in the legitimate stage, or what is called legitimate stage there, ending up with 2.5 years on the stage at Three Penny Opera. The rest is showbiz history. The point of this long story is this. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out of school, or I should say when I dropped out of school. I spent more than a few years finding out. Most of you are very clear about how you're going to spend your life, and I envy you that assuredness. I admire that. The law has certainly become a very specialized, difficult field. I respect anyone willing to tackle not only its complexities, but the temptations and politics that come with the job. What does this have to do with my topic? Why am I standing here? I don't know. Why me? I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a college graduate, much less a postgraduate as you will be. Yet here I am discussing patriotism and other spectator sports. What makes me an expert? One thing for sure, I am involved in politics. I started speaking out and got my feet wet about 8 years ago, and now my feet are so wet they're getting a little pruny. Many people ridicule celebrities for getting involved in politics. At the Democratic convention, there were those who watched the TV coverage and thought, get a load of Rob Lowe, Ed Asner, and the rest of that cabal. Who the hell do they think they are, parading around a convention floor? They criticize actors for using influence over their fans for political or charitable reasons. After all, actors are just hired to say the words, right? Well, I obviously disagree. And some of the most well-informed citizens I know are actors. The more well-known I become as an actor, the more I find myself privy to sources of information that most people aren't. I can call a senator direct and get him on the phone, and not the president, unfortunately, although if 9% more of you had voted for Michael Dukakis, a fellow Harvard law grad, I could have bragged about that too. As a matter of fact, I did call Michael at the State House the other day, and he did come right on the phone. Oh, well, I got to talk to Michael. But I also have strangers write to tell me of their legal problems, or those who have had experiences in El Salvador and Nicaragua. Union members who tell of union busting in their town that never made headlines. So I turn around and I tell you, or whoever will listen, what I have learned. I'm a lightning rod, I guess. That's what a performer should be used for. And what a shame it would be, what a waste, if I didn't use my extra visibility to point out injustice or malfeasance. The marvelous singer and activist Paul Robeson said in 1937, I have longed to see my talent contributing in an unmistakably clear manner to the cause of humanity. There are no impartial observers. Pablo Casals expressed it in a 1970 essay. He said, I know there are those who believe artists should live in an ivory tower, removed from the struggles and suffering of their fellow men. That is a concept to which I have never been able to subscribe. An affront to human dignity is an affront to me. And to protest injustice is a matter of conscience. Are human rights of less importance to an artist than to other men? Does being an artist exempt one from his obligations as a man? If anything, the artist has a particular responsibility because he has been granted special sensitivities and perceptions, and because his voice may be heard when other voices are not. Who indeed should be more concerned than the artist with the defense of liberty and free inquiry, which is essential to his very creativity? That from a musician, a man who didn't need to speak. I'd also like to remind those particular critics that we've had an ex-actor in the White House. And he certainly didn't get there by keeping his mouth shut. I admit, I did keep my mouth shut for a lot of years. I didn't get involved. I was afraid to get involved. If it caused waves, my career might be threatened. And of course, I was a tiny little minnow as an amateur actor, beginning in the days when other actors were being pilloried and blacklisted, creating a trend which will probably last for hundreds of years in terms of reminding people what can happen to them if they shoot their mouths off. I was afraid of making enemies, so I was silent. And when I finally did start to speak out, my career was threatened, and I did make enemies. But despite the negatives I've encountered, once I started speaking up, I couldn't shut up. I think I've attained a certain recognition just for that, especially from those who disagree with me. I get compliments once in a while. The Born Yesterday Company played Denver a few weeks ago, and a woman sent this note backstage. Thanks for being a ray of light and sensibility in a country that just elected a CIA agent and a ditz to be its two top representatives. Well, I'm used to the criticism. Last year, a woman at the Arizona State Legislature called me an American subversive. I kind of like that. Yeah. At least if you go by one 10-year-old's definition of subversive. The 10-year-old was a girl being interviewed for a PBS documentary about El Salvador. She told of witnessing her father's murder by government death squads. He was a Christian lay teacher. The girl was living in a refugee camp and described government soldiers standing outside waiting for, quote, subversives, unquote, to try to leave so they could take them. And in her words, make them disappear. The reporter asked, what is a subversive? The girl answered, and she was beautiful as she said this, I believe a subversive is someone who tells the truth, someone who stands up for his rights. So I don't mind being called a subversive or other names. My motto has become, I'd rather be pissed off than pissed on. I didn't always feel that way. When I was a kid, I had instilled in me a good dose of patriotism. I was taught that being patriotic meant being proud to be an American all the way, and that if you spoke against the government, you were some kind of ingrate, less than a true American. My country, right or wrong. Unfortunately, it's this rote patriotism which has been the dictum of the Reagan-Bush administration. The taint that any questioning of the administration, anyone questioning the Pledge of Allegiance or other symbols of our nation, that makes you un-American, even traitorous. America, love it or leave it. In fact, the whole thrust of the Reagan-Bush administration has been to tell the American people, everything's fine, you can just sit back and watch the Purple Mountain's majesty, we'll take care of everything. If you're a true patriot, you'll just trust us, don't worry, be happy. My experience has taught me differently, that patriotism is not a spectator sport. And it was that changing idea of what patriotism is that finally started me speaking out. I took my first steps literally and figuratively when I walked the picket line and became unofficial spokesman during the 1980 actors' strike. From there, I became interested in Central American politics, Central American issues, and Central American injustices. And it's appropriate that the union was my first cause, since it was a miner strike when I was a teenager that gave me an early lesson in patriotism. There was much press coverage when the coal miners were striking. This is mid-40s, late-40s. I was busily parroting what others said about the strikers, that they should be glad they had any kind of work, they should be glad to live in a free country, and that they shouldn't make waves. The government should clobber them. my high school football coach. A man I greatly respected overheard me, took me aside and said, "Eddie, you can't take away a man's right to strike." Shazam. I remembered his words. He disagreed with all society surrounding me. It was one of my first lessons in First Amendment rights. It doesn't seem any great shake as I repeat it to you. But in conservative Kansas City, Kansas, inundated constantly with the daily press that we had there at that time, it was an earth-shaking statement to me, as well as the awakening that the press wasn't an undeniable god, but it was also a face-to-face with the kind of rebellion and revolution that begets justice, and the kind of patriotism that begets justice. How did patriotism come to mean blind submission and loyalty to a government? We certainly didn't learn it from our forefathers. Our country was born in rebellion against injustice, and all our early leaders were critics of the status quo. They were men who worked for the good of the many, not the few, for the people, not the politicians. Mark Twain spoke of that kind of patriotism. My kind of loyalty is loyalty to one's country, not to its institutions or to its office holders. The country is the real thing to watch over. Institutions are extraneous. They are its mere clothing, and clothing can wear out, become ragged. To be loyal to rags, that is a loyalty of unreason. The only rational patriotism is loyalty to the nation all the time, loyalty to the government when it deserves it. Ronald Reagan's attitude towards Americans was inadvertently made clear when he tried to make a joke as governor of California. He said, "The taxpayer, that's someone who works for the federal government but doesn't have to take a civil service exam." No, Ronnie, you got it backwards. We don't work for the federal government. You and the federal government work for us. And we all have a responsibility to start acting like employers instead of letting the government run over us. And run over us they have. Despite the "don't worry, be happy" attitude of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. We are in a horrible state with our emphasis on military instead of education. We've now got a total of 25 million adults who can't read at all, with an additional 35 million at low literacy levels. 32.5 million people live below the poverty line. 8 million more than in 1978. One-fifth of all children are now poor. A baby born in the shadow of the White House today has less chance of surviving than babies born in many African nations. We spend our money on Star Wars instead of AIDS research. George Bush's lips read "no more taxes" while he advocates revenue enhancements. Corporate taxes are at the lowest level since Pearl Harbor, which, as you know, was September 7th. Where I live, cocaine abuse was up 83% in LA County emergency rooms in just the last 3 years. The area you're concerned with, law, is a joke to the federal government. There are constant abuses of rights, whether you're talking about Iran-Contra or censorship or mandatory drug testing for federal employees. Reagan just last month vetoed the bill, overwhelmingly passed by House and Senate, that would have allowed protection for whistleblowers who would report corruption with federal contractors or other federal bureaus. Since that time, he has also vetoed an ethics bill. You can't even trust the media to report honestly anymore. I don't know if you ever could. You certainly can't today. 26 conglomerates control half of all media in this country today. Conglomerates that count on those tax breaks handed out by the Reagan-Bush administration. Only five corporations control most of the 62 million newspapers sold daily. There are several hundred media organizations around the world that are wholly owned by the CIA, including wire services, newspapers, magazines, TV, and radio. After the election, newsman Sam Donaldson was on a PBS election special talking about the Bush administration's right to lie on their TV commercials. The accountability of the past 8 years has been nearly non-existent, and the responsibility of law, especially on a federal level, is more critical than ever before. Well, I'm only one person, and despite my visibility, I can only produce so loud a bang. I get a lot of letters from people who are involved in legal battles. For instance, a fellow actor, Jay North, who played Dennis the Menace on TV years ago, was doing research for a script at the state penitentiary in Virginia, where he came to know a death row inmate, Earl Clanton. Clanton was convicted of a 1981 murder, had been given the death penalty, and he was sentenced to die on March 17th of this year. Jay was trying to find any means of reclaiming the life sentence for Clanton because the circumstances of his crime and trial were unusual. Clanton's entire childhood was one of sexual and emotional abuse, a situation that usually precludes using the death penalty. But because Clanton couldn't afford a top-notch lawyer, the lawyer he did get wasn't savvy enough to bring out that information in the trial. After his imprisonment, Clanton made several videotapes and films about child abuse, teen suicide, which helped thousands of young people with Clanton's similar background. But because of the backward prison system in Virginia and the bureaucratic red tape and politicking, Jay much more than I, found ourselves fighting the clock, trying to get Clanton's death sentence remanded to life. The judge in the district flip-flopped until the last day. Ultimately, Clanton went to the electric chair in April. It's very difficult to think of human rights in an impersonal way once you're involved in a fight like that. I'm also involved in trying to clear Mark Curtis, a union striker who was set up to take the fall for a rape by an anti-union group in Iowa. Hopi Indians fighting the government for their land in Arizona. All of these cases involve lawyers, but unfortunately, all of these cases involve people who can't afford lawyers. There's an old Hebrew curse: may your life be filled with lawyers. But for some people, that would be a blessing, not a curse. It's times like these that I wish the naysayers were right, that actors had such power. I could say the word, and all of you would decide to go into public service. But I know that won't do it, and truthfully, I don't blame you for going with the big law firms. I understand only 2% of last year's class took public interest or legal services jobs. 67% went into private law firms. I know the temptation when you've been deluged with law firms whining and dining you, courting you to begin work with their firms when you graduate. You're inclined to take the best offer possible. The median salary of lawyers in this country is $65,000, and I'm sure the average Harvard Law School graduate makes more. Of course, that reminds me of the joke of the two lawyers, the rich and the poor, sitting on opposite sides. The center of the desk is a $100 bill. The lights go out. The $100 is gone. Who took it? And the answer, of course, is obvious, that it was the rich lawyer who took it, because the poor lawyer is a figment of your imagination. Actually, a poor lawyer by lawyer standards is a public service lawyer. You know the salaries being offered, and they don't compare with private firms or investment bank offers. Harvard Law School offers grants, a program that was started in 1979 for those going into public service, waivers of school loans that are quite substantial. I'm very impressed with this approach, and it certainly is putting or taking away their money where their mouth was. I believe for the upcoming term, Harvard Law will commit to paying some $400,000 for about 125 graduated Harvard Law students applying for the program. A good incentive, but not really enough to overcome the lure of private practice. One of my favorite lawyers who specializes in public service law is Danny Sheehan, who happens to be one of your graduates. Danny was F. Lee Bailey's litigation associate in the 70s, then went on to become chief counsel in the case of Karen Silkwood against Kerr McGee, the case for the people of Three Mile Island, and so forth. I think the most important was the case he won in North Carolina, where after two trials, in filing a civil suit, he and the Christic people were able to win out against the Nazis and the Klansmen who had butchered, was it five or seven protesters against the Klan and the Nazis. He's been working for the Christic Institute, as I've said, investigating a case for a client peripherally involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, trying to bring the RICO statute against those involved in the drug running and political intrigue in Central America. And his whole driving force is to find out the truth because it's the right thing to do. To protect people's rights because we should. He's seen enough to have the naivete rubbed off him, but his spirit remains. I met him a few years ago in Los Angeles, and he had just finished talking about the Iran-Contra case with a judge he met there. He told the judge what he was finding out, and Danny began speaking eloquently about the rights of American citizens and on and on. The judge got a pensive look in his eye, seemed to be far away. Danny stopped, and the judge said wistfully, "I used to feel that way. What happened to all of us? How did we lose that quintessence, that spirit?" I hope whatever branch of law you do enter, you bring that spirit with you. But if you're in the private sector, make room in your life for those who can't afford your regular fees. Stand up for those who can't stand up for themselves. Time and time again, we've come to doubt ourselves as a nation, question ourselves and our very principles as we discover the clay feet of so many leaders we believed in. I think one of the saddest things was Justice Douglas's article, I think written in the 60s, and I think it appeared in The Atlantic, in which he stated how we invented the word revolution. We created revolution as the modern world now knows it. The modern world looks to us as that symbol of revolution. And from that point onward, we seem to forget where we had stood in terms of the idea of revolution. And subsequently, throughout our history, we have consistently come down on the side of the status quo. I don't have that article in my possession, but I heartily recommend it to your research. But despite all of that, I have come to believe with all my heart that we and the world must believe in the myth of America, in the dream of America. We need it to arm ourselves and go out and question, to provide an ideal of what we wish to become. Our task, yours and mine, along with pursuing careers and the making of bread to feed our families, must be to attempt to turn that myth into reality, and then to guard against it, against those who would stain or besmirch it, not by jingoistic rallying cries of America, love it or leave it, but by seeking justice, by questioning authority. That truly could make America the beautiful. I hope you will hit the ground running and continue the excellence you've begun here. More than ever, our country needs you. The day is short. The work is urgent. It is not your duty to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it. Thank you. I'm told that there's time for questions. If there are any, I will be happy to entertain them, make them laugh, perhaps.
Sir, two quick comments and two questions, if you can handle it. I think the Sam Donaldson thing was on ABC just for information. When you mentioned Sam Donaldson, I think that wasn't Ted. You said PBS, just for the record. I think.
Did I say PBS?
I think it was Ted Koppel.
My mistake. Thank you for
whatever.
The
so, and
well, he is ABC himself. So
right. Yeah. The other thing is, in reference to your comment about Reagan's comment about, you know, you work for the federal government, you just don't take the civil service exam. Actually, what I think is going on there is that the paradox of Reagan at the head of the government appealing to people's sentiments about being overtaxed, when those kinds of comments are made, there's in this mysterious way, the people who are perpetuating that process are actually appealing to people on the grounds that we are paying taxes and not an underrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So I just happen to understand.
So it was his way of
playing to people's
creating his
anti-government
tax
sentiment
platform. I well understand that. Well, let's turn the tables on him.
I hope so.
All right.
My first question is, when you suggest that people going into to practice law, working in the private sector, should set aside some time to do some work for people who can't afford the fees, et cetera, is it really possible to serve two masters? And is it just sort of making people feel better that they give some of their time to rectify a problem that with most of the rest of their time they may well be serving to perpetuate?
Well, that I can't answer that. I would say that is up to each man and each woman as to, one can be totally damned. I damn myself for failures in the past as a good liberal. I have failed my belief in liberalism a few times in the past. And yet, my continued work and striving towards liberal goals and what I consider liberal justice has also done some good. So are we, if we are ineffective and imperfect tools, should we scratch and scotch ourselves totally? I say no, and I think that would be doing that, as you say, if you consider that serving two masters.
Not necessarily. I would agree with you, I guess. My other question is, you've talked about specific struggles, and you've just now talked about an objective having to do with liberal justice. I wonder if you could expand a little on what, if any, a broader, more encompassing political vision for America would be for you. And in other words, there are specific things that could be done in specific situations, mm-hmm. and people need to be inspired to do that, which I think is something that you're doing today. I'm just wondering if you have a vision that is a little more, a broader, more encompassing vision and ideas that you have, what the direction for political action in that regard might be.
I'm an emotional, call it dreamer, but I have also lived long enough to know that unless you work at the dream and unless you believe in the dream, you ain't worth much, and that those who do work at the dream can capture a piece of it. I believe that is possible. I believe that the trip is worth it. Right off the bat, I would say that for the liberals, the program to set off in is to repair the damage of the 8 years of Reaganism, to restore the aid to education, to restore the warm breakfasts and the warm lunches where they've been cut, to restore the health aids, the health examinations, to strike off on a total massive program of overturning this horrendous illiteracy that is besetting our nation now, and finding some way to offset it, to combat it, to create a massive dedication by the youth of this country to repairing the infrastructure of this country through a massive Peace Corps, be it a CCC of sorts sent into the city to clean up the debris and the befouling of our cities, and to create volunteers within the cities themselves to find some way to either tax or to volunteer to fix the highways, the bridges that bind us together. To clean up the harbors. There are, I believe, in national service for one thing. I would love to see a dedication, a law passed by this country, a massive outpouring of funds and attention, wherein every youth out of high school, male, female, halt, lame, blind, I don't care what they are, put in 2 years of service to the country. That, to me, would be the patriotism I would like to see, rather than wrapping oneself in George Bush's American flag and Pledge of Allegiance, and thereby sending out throughout this country, breaking apart the bourgeois protectionism that so many of us enjoy, getting us into the poverty pockets, getting us to know our neighbors. That, to me, would be an education, a widening, a broadening of America, and get us once again rededicated to saving this country rather than attending to our police duties throughout the world.
Sir?
May I address for a moment the try to answer the young man's first question?
Certainly.
I am an elderly graduate of this school who has reached the status of counsel in the Boston law firm, which does what you have advocated to a substantial extent in trying to redress some of the wrongs of society and represent people, for example, a woman who is threatened with being thrown out of her home and in the Cambridge apartment house. And we don't regard that as a conflict of interest. One of the principal parts of our practice represents real estate owners and developers, and we wouldn't, of course, represent the owner of that particular property against that particular property. We see nothing wrong with doing what we are doing, and if our clients in general don't approve of it, that's their problem. Thank you.
Thank you. We knew that all the time, though, didn't we?
I'm not a student, but I'm on staff here at Harvard Law School, and I'm a member of the newly certified Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers, AFSCME.
Well, congratulations on your long victory fight.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to personally thank you for your show of support. My question is, if you could address, but if you perceive any trends currently in unionism throughout the nation and its relevance to the workplaces of the 1980s and 90s, and not only its relevance in terms of working people such as myself, but also for the students who may be interested in labor law and labor management relations.
Well, the news of labor's death is certainly premature. Labor will certainly become an all-embracing word, because you're a white-collar worker, and you certainly aren't the vision of labor as we have come to know it in the past. I think you're a perfect example of where labor is going. Certainly the universities, the schools, and those of you, both teachers and clerical staffs throughout the country, are becoming the vast main population of organized labor. I think this white-collar trend will continue ad infinitum, and I suppose there will be a danger of losing the connection, if you'll forgive the expression, with the peones at the bottom of the economic ladder. And I think labor must never lose sight of that in the area of becoming that white-collar organization. I think it has to guard against that and must work fervently to remind and to goad the middle-class workers it is now beginning to represent of their connection to the bottom of the rung. And I think if it does that successfully, and of course they will be the hardest to organize in so many respects, because they are the most intimidated. They are the least secure. It is the hardest battle, and I would hope that labor would concentrate its efforts through that, because it is always through the middle class that we have been able to bring the organizing efforts to the laboring unions. And I would hope that those efforts are sustained, and I certainly would say that that would probably be, with labor maintaining every hold it can upon the middle class unions, striving desperately to try to get to the bottom to create that basis for American labor in general. And I think that's the greatest problem, organizing the poor. Thank you.
Ed, I just wanted to say something. I mean, like, I've been dealing with cases in the federal court, and I'm not an attorney. Being poor myself and having my parents die on me, it hasn't been easy. But when you say that there's corruption within this government itself, you're not wrong. I've been dealing with laws of Congress, where not even in this state has the law been enacted upon. And because we were dealing with a political year this year, it seems like everybody was just shuffling it and nobody wanted to be bothered with it. The issue I raise is that even when I've had a lawyer, he's gone into that federal court and he has said he's assisting me. I'm totally blind and handicapped. He's not assisting me. He's supposed to be there to represent me. And if this is any way that lawyers are appointed and supposed to be there to protect them, sometimes people are better off trying to protect themselves than they are when they deal with an attorney. I've gotten more aid and assistance from some of the college students from Harvard and some of the other schools, and even some of the professors, than I can say, damn it, in the federal court of law. I've gone to the Department of Justice at the federal court. I had to go all the way to Washington myself in August to try to get the Department of Justice to do something. They said if it doesn't break after the elections and after they have a new election in January, you know, when the new administration, come back in February. Mind you, I've been shuffled from shelters and places across this state. It's not fair to me because they've taken my home from me illegally. No notice from court. They just plowed through my apartment, took out everything, and stuck me in places. And trying to get in a lawyer and getting the ball rolling at the courthouse and dealing with politicians in this state, it hasn't been easy. I don't feel people in this state should be subjected in the wrong frame of mind. And if they aren't appointed with an attorney that's going to really help them, they don't really need one. You're better off going into Washington, pulling people from colleges and advocating for your rights there. I do try to advocate for people. Now I'm trying to advocate for myself. I was out there dealing with homelessness all summer long. We went into Washington, and there's still a big deal about it. They're still sitting back. We've got many, many people that are dying right here in Boston. We've got people across the country that aren't even eating. At least in Boston, we've got people that are getting food. When you start opening up shelters, you're dealing with dictatorship in this state. That went out in this years ago. When are we going to bring back the Constitution? Those are the issues I raise. When we go to law school and we learn something, and I was at Harvard for a year before I went totally blind, I'm grateful to the students here. They helped me to write a book. But the issues I raise is that when we are practicing to be lawyers, that we don't protect the wrong people, that we protect the right. And even if people are in government and making mistakes, we've got to find those people and start protecting the ones we're supposed to and bring the facts out in the open. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And good luck. No.
I was wondering if you could comment on American television and if you think it has anything to do with bringing about the state of disrepair that you described in the country. And also, if you watch television and what your favorite TV shows are.
The ones I just got canceled with. I should inform you that Bronx Zoo was credited as being current. Bronx Zoo, excuse me, Bronx Zoo no longer exists either. And I think it had something to say. I think it had something to teach and to show. I feel that the disrepair that American television has fallen into is certainly symptomatic of the general downward spiral of information provided in this country and encouragement and hope. I think the quality of TV has descended. I think the networks more and more are appealing to the lowest common denominator in terms of what they are putting on. And the vast wasteland has, in my opinion, proliferated. I don't know. We would be so much better off, I think, if we had one network. We have nothing to lose if we acquired one network. God knows the British are certainly getting far more cluck per buck than we do over here. They seem to be working more and more trying to emulate us, which I think is stupid and is merely reflective of the dollar. Getting back to that Donaldson remark, Kirk O'Donnell furiously replied to Donaldson that if any of the slurs and innuendos and misinformation had been done in print, as the Bush people had, and both sides in a way, but certainly the Bush people, had done in television, had done in print what they had done in television, they would both be sued for criminal libel. I think that's sad, that inequality of laws there create that type of imbalance. So I'm not at all encouraged by what TV is doing, and certainly my own fates and my own fortune has... I'll give you a very interesting story. One of the three sponsors that canceled advertising on Lou Grant was Vidal Sassoon, and its president was Joseph Solomon. And at the height of the controversy, he wrote a letter to President May of CBS saying, "Can't you shut this man up? We've gotten 6 or 7 letters." President May, to his credit, wrote back and said, "We do not interfere with the performer's freedom of speech." Very nice letter. And a month later, the show was canceled. And I would say that the three sponsors who did pull out or try to pull out at the time were Kimberly Clark, oftentimes connected with the right, Vidal Sassoon, and Cadbury's. But I was very strongly assured by a vice president of CBS that other sponsors were standing in line to take their place, for that matter. But I share your gloom about TV. Sir?
Yes. I'm currently the director of clinical programs at the law school, but come from New York City, where I was a legal services lawyer and also president of the National Lawyers Guild chapter for 2 years. The people here should know that every year you took out an ad in our journal, really the only public figure to do so, and you had a very interesting and important statement. You wrote each year, "You give me great courage," and you addressed it to the National Lawyers Guild. As an organization here, the National Lawyers Guild is not in ascendancy, and I was hoping you could take the opportunity to explain the remark to the students here and why you think the Guild is such an important organization.
I'd rather you say it, because I would fear it. They do give me courage. They have taken stands. They have fought where traditional middle ground organizations, they have been pilloried, they have been pursued, they have been hounded and haunted, and I suppose blacklisted in most senses. So by such a performance in the past, I do take courage, but I would prefer you go beyond that.
Well, I mean, you've said it well. I think that, it's important to understand that the Guild, which is now 50 years old, began simply because the American Bar Association simply did not admit blacks. And it began in the midst of the Roosevelt era, and it was a way of saying that law, in its own words, in the preamble to its constitution, in the service that human needs were more important than property needs. And that is what the Guild is about, and I thank you for coming here because I think you embody that same spirit.
You honor me. Thank you.
I wondered if you have any thoughts on strategy as an activist. Activist strategy. You obviously are a successful actor, but from your very description, I get the impression that your activism has usually been disappointing. For example, the caucus, the homeless, and so on. I wondered whether you would continue to pursue your support of a cause, even if you suspected that it was that your very involvement was counterproductive in the sense that it was generating opposition, antagonism, not only for yourself, but for the cause.
Absolutely. And I can't tell you, I mean, we of the left are fumblers and bumblers. I think we stay up nights working to be that way. We perfect it. It's an art of perfection. And I would say that if it's for us to keep the ground arable, just keep turning it over and, you know, throwing in a few nutrients now and then, a little bullshit here, a little bullshit there, waiting for a zapata to come down from the hills, because there will be a zapata who can sow the seeds that will make that ground grow and will make our principles live and will, you know, restore. The best example I can give to you is that Ronald Reagan preached Nicaragua is our enemy for 8 solid years. They were going to march into Harlingen, Texas, if you recall. There wasn't a poll in this country, short of the 90 days ascendancy that Ali North enjoyed, when those polls changed and when they did not indicate that two-thirds of the American people did not approve of our policy in Central America. I don't know how the hell they got to feeling that way. But they vehemently and strongly disagreed, were against contra aid, and opposed the policy of this administration. And it is because of people like this who constantly stand there putting out the time, putting out the protests, putting out the mottos and the statements, putting out the bucks when they got them, that keep that field alive and keep the majority of American people. There is a, you know, this country is not as predominantly conservative as this election has indicated. I think if we ever mount an effective campaign as a band of the left, of progressives, liberals, whatever you want to call them, 6 years ago, at least 6 years ago, Gary Hart was running from the term liberal, calling himself a neoliberal, and that's when I first began to despise him. Others, I think Mr. Bradley of New Jersey liked calling himself that for a while. Then they realized that they were tripping themselves up too much with this evasiveness and forgot about it. Michael ran into it in this election and failed the test badly when cornered on the question. And I think despite what the polls say, because the polls are shaped and manufactured like anything else is, like a loaf of bread is, I think within a very short space of time, liberals properly mounting and selling themselves and displaying to the world just who they are, what they are, what they have done for this country, and pointing to every man and woman and showing how they all benefit, no matter whether they're rich or poor, It would take the meanest, lowest Madison Avenue firm to be able to do that job. And unfortunately, none have done it.
In the meantime, though, did it occur to you that you might actually help the caucus more by supporting Bush? In other words, as a strategy, you might actually be able to help your cause more by supporting the opposition or appearing to support the opposition. That's what I meant by strategy.
Oh, you mean take because I'm an albatross?
Well, I guess what I mean is, I wonder whether you think you helped the caucus, but I really am wondering whether you're more interested in the cause or being right.
I could be a corpulent Trojan horse, is what you're saying.
Well, as a strategy.
Well, I'm not that bright. Where were you when I needed you? Or where were you when Michael needed you?
Seriously, that hasn't occurred to you?
No.
I think it occurs to some people.
Really?
Yes. Not.
Well,
not
no, I full well realize that, what was it, 2 years ago, but both 2 years, 2 years ago and 4 years ago, that the only requests I got from Democrats to appear in their state were guys who were crapshooters. I know that. Staid, stolid, prosperous burger Democrats didn't invite me into their territory. So I, innately, subconsciously, I knew it. But if you run, I'll be glad to stay away.
If there's time, I'd like to follow up sort of on an earlier point. I think while there's common, a lot of common ground around a lot of the sorts of struggles that you're referring to, there are some questions about differences in perspective across the spectrum of the left, where there may be important differences in vision between, say, a liberal perspective and a more radical perspective, whatever it might mm-hmm. be referred
always
to.
Always has been. That's why we have a harder time.
Right. I wonder, then, how deep your analysis of the roots of the sources of the problems that we, I think, share feelings and a perspective about, where the roots and sources of these sorts of problems are, and to what extent they rest in the problems having to do with private ownership of productive resources, which raises the question of the efficacy of a capitalist organization of the society, and obviously also immediately raises the question of the alternative of the alternative efficacy, the efficacy of an alternative model vision involving some form of some socialist alternative.
Well, I am not that expert a maven. I can only say that the marketplace will dictate, the need will dictate in this country. I go back to the fact that Roosevelt saved us from the revolution, supposedly. And I suppose that the same types of redresses and balances will take place as the need arises in this country, even if it's George Bush. Because I think he's a clever man, and I think he will do what he can to stay in power. I tend to think that we, as a nation, including myself, of course, are fairly comical. I think that we, as a nation, when we present radicals to our populace, we follow Jerry Rubin's. We follow Tom Hayden's, Abby Hoffman's, who still tries to do an honest day's radical work where he can. We follow Eldridge Cleaver's, who is on parole right now, I guess, for shoplifting. I'm afraid we are so bereft of true heroes. Of a radical nature that we really have no place to turn, and we are all suspect and we are all condemned, in my opinion. I think that the Dave Dellingers, the Berrigan brothers, are buried on page 28 and never see the light of day in the eyes of most of the populace, that we have a very effective way of stifling the fulsome images of radicalism in this country, of those people who could teach us the true way, and I don't know how to overcome it unless the children's crusade begins again. But I have no solution, and I think the effective means of scotching and bottling up are wonderfully effective and successful. And until I would contribute anything I could to let the genie out of the bottle, but I don't know how to do it.
Just to continue with your, the Dellingers are buried on page 28. What do you see as the relationship between the incoming Bush administration and the media, which I find rather too cozy for my tastes? How do you predict that the media are going to be covering the new administration? And if your prediction is what I think it's going to be, how can we get a little bit more sunlight into what's really going on?
Well, yeah, yes, I think they're very cozy. At the same time, I think that the media, I think the media gave the Democrats and Michael Dukakis every opportunity to avail themselves of meaningful thrusts, meaningful space, and the blundering ox and bull in the china shop stepped on the thrusts and broke the lances that could have been. I think the sound bites, the video bites were all there. And for once, one of the few times in 8 years, I think the media did allow themselves to override publishers and editors and create the opening which was not seized upon. I think they turned to George Bush with relief after these heroic efforts that they consider they were in their mind, that the Democrats fumbled, and they will be kissy-kissy. I don't mind that as long as the problems begin to get solved. I just hope and pray that as the sins of commission or omission are uncovered, that the honeymoon allows those zits to be shown. And it's up to us to keep up the battle against the media, because I think some of that attitude towards Michael Dukakis and the Democrats was aggravated and accelerated by us and crying out against the media all those years. And I think that even in the best of times, you can't afford to get your throat, if you've got it, get your foot, I should say, if you've got it there, off the throat of the media. They don't deserve it.